This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, Waiting to Exhale, is based on a best-selling novel by Terry McMillan. She also co-wrote the screen adaptation. Waiting to Exhale tells the story of four women whose friendships support them through their troubled relationships with men. As McMillan puts it, each of the four women is waiting to exhale, waiting for the man who will take her breath away. The movie stars Whitney Houston and Angela Bassett. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with Terry McMillan recorded in 1992, just after the publication of Waiting to Exhale. McMillan is also the author of the novels Mama and Disappearing Acts, and the editor of an anthology of contemporary African-American fiction called Breaking Ice. When I spoke with her, I asked her to read from Waiting to Exhale.
Right now, I'm supposed to be all geeked up because I'm getting ready for a New Year's Eve party that some guy named Lionel invited me to. Sheila, my baby sister, insisted on giving me his phone number because he lives here in Denver, and her simpleton husband played basketball with him 11 years ago at the University of Washington. And since I'm still single, which is downright pitiful to her, considering I'm the oldest of four kids and the only one who has yet to say I do, she's worried about me. She and Mama both think I'm out here dying of loneliness, which is not true. I mean, I have my days and I have my nights, but I haven't gotten to the point where I'll take whatever I can get. There's a big difference between being thirsty and being dehydrated. But Sheila and Mama have always thought that something was better than nothing, and look where it's gotten them. Mama, who thinks she's an expert on everything, hasn't had a whole man in her life for 17 years. And if I knew where my daddy was, I'd probably kill him for making her such a bitter woman. He broke her heart, and she's never recovered. And Sheila, she files for divorce on an annual basis and calls me collect from some cheap motel where she and the kids are hiding out until she can serve the papers on Paul. I listen to her whine for hours about how sick she is of him and that there's nothing he can do or say that would make her go back this time. But then, like a fool, she turns right around and calls him up, repeats her long list of needs that aren't being met, and he promises to give her anything she wants. She refuses to believe him, so he begs on a daily basis for 2 weeks, and by then he's convinced her that he means it, so she gives in and goes on back home. I rarely hear from her while they're honeymooning, except maybe a 3-minute synopsis of how hunky-dory everything is now, and because he's given her permission to go ahead and rip out the old carpet or buy some new dining room furniture, she's watching her money, which is why she can't talk long. One of my brothers is in prison for doing something stupid, passing counterfeit money, but he's not a criminal. And the other one's a lifer in the Marine Corps, so as far as taking advice from any of them goes, I'm skeptical. The deal is the men are dead in Denver, which is only one reason why I'm leaving. I'm tired of this altitude, all this damn snow, and this obsession with the Denver Broncos. For the last 3 years, my life has felt inconsequential, like nobody really gives a damn what I'm doing or how well I do it. From the outside, everything looks good. I've got a decent job, money in the bank, live in a nice condo, and drive a respectable car. I've got everything I need except a man. And I'm not one of these women who thinks that a man is the answer to everything, but I'm tired of being by myself. Being single isn't half as much fun as it used to be.
Terry McMillan, when was being single fun?
When I was in my 20s, before I had my son, before I became a mother.
Because
I didn't care. I wasn't so interested in getting married at the time. I was having a ball.
Uh-huh. And then you became a mother, a single mother, soon after becoming a mother, and I guess that changed things?
Well, I think once I was in my early 30s, it wasn't just being a mother, to be honest with you. It was being in my 30s. And then I looked up one day, and I was 35. And then I was 36, and then 37, and then 38. And then I said, wait a minute. Something is wrong with this picture. So, it's not like I'm miserable. I'm not miserable. But I would prefer that it not be this way. But like Savannah, I'm not ready to take whatever I can get. Because if that's the case, I would have been divorced 5 times by now. Because I have been proposed to. But then I looked at him and said, I don't think so. Not the rest of my life.
Does each of the four women in your new novel represent one of your friends or a certain type of woman?
I think more type. No, after having been threatened by a lawsuit for disappearing acts, I made sure. I mean, I even cleared some of these chapters with some of my friends to make sure that they did not feel as if they were being portrayed. But fortunately, women are a lot smarter than men. And a lot of my friends said, don't even worry about it, Terry. I've been in that situation before, and in some instances I was aware of it and some I wasn't. So they just told me, look, you know, a lot of this stuff we all can identify with, so don't, I'm not taking this personally, because I didn't lift my friend's experiences and put them in the book. I made a point of not doing that this time around.
Novelist Terry McMillan is my guest. I'd like to get your reaction to something that David Nicholson wrote in a review of your previous book in the Washington Post. He wrote, McMillan may have created a whole new category, the post-feminist black urban romance novel. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't like to think of my books as romance novels, first of all, but I sort of know what he meant. I think it was meant to be flattering, but I don't like to think of myself as being up there with Danielle Steele and Judith Krantz and the like. I think what he was inferring, at least the way I took it, was that you don't often see romance in novels by black authors. And I deal with sexuality, sensuality, a certain amount of eroticism. And you get to see black men and black women showing and demonstrating a certain amount of passion towards each other, where in a lot of our work it's absent. Not all of our work, because there are other people that do it, but it prevails in my work, because I'm just interested in intimacy, to be honest with you.
Let me ask you about the type of criticism that I think this book might end up getting. One, the criticism that these women are too obsessed with men.
It's bullshit. Excuse me. That's a crock of doo-doo. They are not too obsessed with men. The bottom line is this, is that if they were lesbians, they may be more obsessed with women, but it just so happens they're heterosexuals. And I don't think there's anything embarrassing about wanting a companion and wanting to be loved and wanting to love someone. There's nothing embarrassing about that. And, you know, there are too many of us out here right now walking around, parading around, we're living alone, and we're getting by and acting as if it's everything is just okay. But if you had it the way you wanted it, you would not be alone. And I don't see them as being obsessed, because they have other things going on in their lives that they are as concerned about. Their children, their parents, their jobs, you know, their own lives, their bodies, everything. It's not just men, but men fit into the whole picture as well. And I don't see anything wrong with that.
Another criticism I can imagine you getting is that you've made black men look bad.
Are you saying that?
No, I'm saying it's a criticism I can imagine you getting. I'm not criticizing you for it. I'm not saying you did that, but I'm saying, look, on the back of your book, there's a quote from Spike Lee, who's kind of predicting that you're going to get this criticism. I'll read the quote.
You don't have to read it.
No, I'll read it. I've got it right here. He says, "No doubt when this book is published, the author will hear once again, as Zaki Shange did for Colored Girls, Alice Walker for The Color Purple, and Gloria Naylor for The Women of Brewster Place, the cries that the black man has been wronged, the black man has been dogged. I disagree. Terry McMillan has crafted a well-written, truthful, and funny story of four African-American women, four sisters who are trying to make it in this world we all live in, and the sometimes volatile world of black-female, black-male relationships." Signed, Spike Lee.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, you're anticipating this kind of criticism, or your publisher is.
Well, you know, no, I don't think my publisher was. I'm really kind of surprised. I mean, I've done about maybe five readings now, and the brothers are sort of coming up with, they wait to the end, till after everybody has asked their questions and made their little comments and stuff, and then they sort of almost eke out, do you think you're going to get criticized? I mean, they haven't, like, jumped on me yet.
What's the origin of that Spike Lee quote? Did the publisher ask him for a quote?
No, Spike read the book, and he said, you know, Terry, you know they're going to jump all over you. And I said, yeah, Spike, I know, but I told a story I wanted to tell, and I'm prepared for it, because I'm not going to let the African-American community dictate how I tell a story. And also, when I tell a story, I wish they would just get it once and for all, that we, not just myself, but other African-American writers, you know, we're not trying to represent the entire black race. We are telling a story about the characters that inhabit the pages of our book. That's it. You know, and the ones who usually are whining and complaining are the ones who are usually guilty. So I'm not falling for it. I'm just not falling for it. And they can't tell me what to write. And if they don't like it, don't read it. You know, it's some good brothers out here, and the brothers out here who are cool know who they are.
We're featuring an interview with Terry McMillan, recorded in 1992 after the publication of her novel Waiting to Exhale. A new film based on the novel just opened. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with Terry McMillan, the author of Waiting to Exhale.
Do you think that there's a different set of problems in black couple relationships than in white couple relationships?
Well, yes and no. I think that all of us have baggage that we bring to a relationship, especially the older we get. I think that black men bring a different kind of baggage. They may bring similar baggage that white men have, but in addition to that, sometimes it's the racial thing. Some of the things that black men have been through, a lot of white men have never experienced. But then again, if we talk about humiliation, there's no color on that. If we talk about helplessness, there's no color on that. But with black men, if the cause of that helplessness is a result of racism, then that's different. Then it's different. But for the most part, a lot of women in general are just sick of being disappointed, sick of men who are afraid of making a commitment, men who are afraid of intimacy, men who lie, men who don't keep their promises. And in that sense, there's no color separation here. I don't know what it's going to take for them to understand that they're missing out on a lot of stuff by being such wusses and being so scared of everything. I mean, there are a lot of really wonderful women and beautiful and smart, intelligent women out here that they seem to be so threatened by and so intimidated by. And, you know, just because we are career women doesn't mean that we still don't want them or love them or care about them or want to share our lives with them. And, I it's as if men think that if they fall in love and it doesn't work, that they're going to die, you know?
When you were growing up, did the couples around you, the parents, or, you know, your friends' parents, the aunts and uncles, your parents, the other parents in the neighborhood, did they seem to have good relationships?
A lot of them did. I mean, there were some, I mean, where I grew up, people used to fight. I mean, literally hit each other. In my house, they did. My mother used to hit my father with frying pans, and he'd hit her and punch her lights out and stuff. I mean, violence was, it was almost everywhere. But then again, there were other family members who were more civilized. So I got to see both sides of the coin, and I choose to identify with the kind that was gentle and tender. I saw both, which is why I think I felt this dichotomy. Like, I didn't understand why men and women had to hit each other to make a point. You know, is this the only way you can vent your anger out on each other? And oftentimes, you know, the other person wasn't even the cause of the anger. It was some other stuff. And that's the part that used to baffle me, which is why one time I tried to kill my father for hitting my mother, because I knew she hadn't done anything wrong. I don't think we get that as much. I mean, there are still young men out here who think that the only way they can exercise their masculinity is by hitting their wives or their girlfriends. And they don't understand what it does to children when the children have to see this.
What did you do that time when you almost killed your father, when you tried to?
Well, not so much kill him. What I did was, I didn't know where I got the strength from. I literally just picked him up. And I think I was about 9 or 10. I literally ran between him, he and my mother, and I just picked him up by his shirt and threw him up against the wall. I've done it twice. I mean, I stopped a man from stabbing my mother once. I took the knife out of his hand and put it up to his throat and told him if he ever in his life ever thought about hurting my mother again. And I swear to God, I was getting ready to kill him. And I was 13, and I will never forget it. And he thought I was crazy, and I was. But not so much that I did it. But I had that knife puncturing his skin, and I swear to God, I'd have killed him. I just told him, you put your hands on my mother again, you're dead.
Who was he?
I don't want to say.
Okay.
I mean, it doesn't matter who he was. He wasn't my father.
Mm-hmm.
But You know, alcohol and drugs are usually what precipitates a lot of this action. You rarely see a man sober hitting his wife, unless he's really nuts. Usually it's alcohol or some controlled substance that causes them to go off. That's what I found to be true.
Terry McMillan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Terry McMillan recorded in 1992 after the publication of her novel Waiting to Exhale. She co-wrote the screenplay for the new film adaptation.